Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. It's June 18th, 2017.
Yes, still through that.
Father's Day. Happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
A little belated.
No, it's not belated.
I mean, by the time people hear this, it will be belated.
Yeah, right.
But we're having a terrific day. And we're thinking about our dads. I got to say, one of my favorite memories of my dad is really when we worked together setting up the cranberry food sampler. He actually helped us renovate the shop. We bought this building and we had partners and we were putting together a gourmet shop in downtown Cranberry, New Jersey. And Steuben Granger was sort of the head contractor of the job. And he and his good friend, Carl Litke, and I did all kinds of work together. And it was great. That was the most fun. Working together with him as a young adult was really a great memory and kind of forged a new aspect of our relationship that I really look back with a lot of love and fondness.
That's good. I mean, my dad was my Little League manager. For years. And the funny thing about that is that we won all the time. We had a championship season after championship season. And I can tell you that the way to be a championship manager in Little League is to have your son be the best player in the league. And that was not my dad's formula because he had me, who was pretty good, but not the best player in the league. Why did we win? I often wondered about that. And what I think I learned from my dad then and otherwise is the importance of being relaxed. My dad's relaxed.
He is relaxed.
And it's contagious. And the truth of the matter is, when you're relaxed, you keep your eye on the ball, literally and figuratively, and you do better. It's an effective way to approach things. And it was a valuable lesson then. It's still the only explanation I can come up with why that team never lost a game. It was kind of amazing. So in any event, happy Father's Day to my dad. We visited just yesterday out in Long Island.
All right, happy Father's Day.
Oh, okay. So because it is Father's Day, I feel
you can talk about what you want.
Empowered to begin the discussion with sports. In particular, I'm going to talk about the NBA. The NBA championship just concluded, and of course, Golden State Warriors prevailed. They lost only one game in the playoffs. They were the dominant team, and it led to a lot of hand-wringing about the fact that they'll never lose again. And the formula for success was pretty simple. They were the best team.
Were they relaxed?
I think they must. Yeah, they looked very relaxed, winning by 20 points every time. And they were almost the best team, certainly the best team in the league generally over the last 2 years, and they came up with the brilliant idea of adding the best player in the league that they did not already have. That would be Kevin Durant. And they said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll get Kevin Durant, we'll pay him $26 million, and that may make us even better. And you know what? They were entirely correct about that. So they won the championship. People are saying, let's break up the Warriors. I'll just add that that's not necessary. The last team to go through the playoffs and lose only one game was the 1982 Philadelphia 76ers, when Moses Malone famously predicted that the results of the championship rounds would be 4-4-4, meaning 4-0 each time. He only missed by one. That team has not won a championship in the next 30-some-odd years. So I wouldn't worry about that. And, of course, the way the other teams will catch up is through the lottery, which we've heard a lot about, ping-pong balls dropping the teams vie for the best pick in the draft, and they try to get the next Kevin Durant to compete.
You know, I'm a Kevin Durant fan.
I didn't know that, but that's all.
Because he's a big, he's great about his mom. He's quite devoted to his mom.
Not the $26 million? That's
there is that, but I root for a guy
like
that.
Well, that's good. It's all to the good. And he was the first pick in the draft, and the ping pong balls fell correct for the team that got him. That was Oklahoma City at one point. But in any event, what I thought more interesting this week about basketball than the Golden State Warriors was an article about Bobby Hurley and St. Anthony's. And who was Bobby Hurley? Bobby Hurley is a high school basketball coach and has been for many years. He's 69 years old now. He's probably been coaching for 30, 35 years. St. Anthony, being a Catholic school in New Jersey, which has enjoyed enormous basketball success with Bob Hurley, notwithstanding that it is not a wealthy school, does not have much in the way of facilities, does not have a big school population. Yet Bob Hurley, in coaching that team, led them to 13 state championships and 8 undefeated seasons, which makes sort of no sense. It's a remarkable story. And part of what's remarkable about the story is that the kids are kids who really have nothing. One of the things that comes through in the article about Bob Hurley is that when the kids were interviewed recently, and they were just giving away all the team's trophies because the school's closing. The school's closing for lack of money. The Archdiocese decided it wasn't economically viable anymore, and they're going to sell the building. And he just had a gathering in which he asked the players to come back and take whatever they wanted, and they all had stories like, I'll just read some quotes. One of the players, "We were so poor, the coach would drive through our neighborhoods, making sure we weren't outside when we shouldn't be." Another player, "Before I played for Coach Hurley, I'd never been in a restaurant." Another player saying that he joined the team when a neighbor of his or a friend of his had been killed by a stray bullet in the neighborhood. He said, "When I transferred to St. Anthony's, I felt it like God saying to me, your life is saved." And Bob Hurley was on a mission. Bob Hurley was not only a coach, he was a teacher, and he was a probation officer part-time to augment his salary. And I happened to see a film of Bob Hurley coaching that team. And what's interesting about that is, you know, it was such a nice story. You expected to see him putting his arm around the kids and guiding them through life. Mm-hmm. He was screaming at these kids mm-hmm. every single second. Some, mm-hmm. without any context, would think he was almost abusive, right in their faces, mm-hmm. throughout practice, mm-hmm. unrelenting. Mm-hmm. Bob Hurley is a coach, an extremely tough guy. But that's what he felt was necessary to get their attention.
Yeah.
Now, he not only had players that succeeded at high school, an enormous number of them went to college. And beyond that, about 10 of them became NBA players, including his son, which is even that much more remarkable. But the thing about them, when you watch these kids coaching by Hurley, being coached by Hurley, he clearly felt he had to scream at them to get their attention. But what's really driving these kids? And what's really driving is these kids is they want to be the next Kevin Durant. Mm-hmm. In other words, that's the basketball lottery. Mm-hmm. That's the lottery they're all entered into. These kids have nothing, and yet they're playing for $26 million. Mm. And Bob Hurley's coaching them because he knows none of them are going to get that $26 million, or very few. And he's coaching them for the life in between, which many of them have managed to succeed at. And it's just such a terribly sad thing that programs close, that school is closed, and Bob Hurley won't be coaching anymore.
And kids like that are left.
You'd like to think there are other alternatives, but that's a big resource gone.
All right. Well, speaking in terms of dollars.
Yes.
And value.
Yeah.
And the lottery. There is a humorous essay in the Wall Street Journal this weekend by Joe Queenan. Actually, what I found interesting about it were the facts that it's based on. And that is to say that a lot of old school classic style paintings now that you would think are worth millions are beginning to diminish in value in favor of more modern art. Mm-hmm. And he quotes an example of a painting by Jean-Léon Gérôme of Bathsheba, which in 1990 sold for $2.2 million at a Sotheby's auction. And a couple weeks ago, same painting in London sold for a mere $630,000, from $2.2 million to $630,000. He also mentions that paintings such as landscapes by Corot, landscape master have failed to even be sold, even at low estimated / reserve prices mm-hmm. at auction. And that meanwhile, while you can't even sell a Corot, Jean-Michel Basquiat painting recently sold for $110 million.
Yeah.
So he suggests all kinds of hilarious advertising marketing gimmicks mm-hmm. that gallery owners could put forth, such as buy one Velasquez, get 50% off a Zurbaran, etc. And so it's all kind of mocking and ridiculous. But there is that interesting point that art, like many investments, go through ups and downs.
Yeah, tremendous ups and downs.
When you buy something like that, even though it's fine if you're considering an investment, but you just better like it, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they say that when you buy a house too.
Right.
You know, make sure you want to live there because you don't really know if it's going to appreciate in the ways you imagine.
But the other point is thing, people tend to think that things have a certain value or have been going up in price. They'll always
and
go
will
up.
Never
they'll
go down.
They'll always have value. And things go up and they go down. I mean, when you go back to the NBA, there was an article in the NBA about the fact that, it's prompted by the fact that the NBA is now going to allow sponsors' names on the uniforms of the players because apparently they're not making enough money. But put that aside. The humble origins of the NBA very much...
Does this benefit the players or the owners?
Both. And they're working together. But the interesting thing is that the NBA used to rely on just that sort of thing. When you talk about the 1940s and the NBA starting, you had a team called the Fort Wayne General Electrics. They competed with the Indianapolis Kautskys. That was a wholesale grocery store called Kautskys. And there were two teams in Akron. One was called the Akron Goodyear Wingfoots, and another was called the Akron Firestone Nonskids.
And I wouldn't mind rooting for the Nonskids.
Well, you're going to have a chance because they're going to have their logo on the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Will they really call them with those nicknames?
I think the Cleveland team is going to be known as the Goodyear Wingfoots, at least in slang,
because
it will be on their uniform.
Here come the Wingfoots.
But what reflected was a past in which the players got paid $10 or $12 a week. This is 1937. Now, I understand dollars change. That's worth $200 today. They were getting $200
a week.
And Kevin Durant, $26 million. How have things changed? Here's from the Times article on this. Writing in the New York Times, Arthur Daly saw the new NBA as a step forward. This is in 1949, but still was skeptical. He contended that pro basketball was, quote, slightly worse than pro football, if such a thing be possible, as a surefire method of throwing away money. Okay, so Arthur Daly turned out to be pretty wrong about that. But listen, I grew up reading Arthur Daly. I wasn't reading in 49, but he went on for quite some time. That's not the Wild West. That's not in 1755. So Arthur Daly in 1949 said that you're throwing away money with these franchises, and yet they're worth zillions. In the same way the Basquiat has gone up in value since then. So, go figure. All right, but speaking of something which I can't imagine is going to be worth zillions, but it's an interesting economic proposition, is salt. And what I mean in particular is there's a new thing.
I know you're a spa guy.
I am a spa.
On vacation, you did seek out some steam rooms. Yeah. You were happy when spa.
I go to a sauna once in a while. Yeah. I admit it. But I never went to a salt spa. And there's just, not only that, there's such a thing as a salt sauna.
So it's a new
sauna.
Thing.
It's a new thing, and it's alarming. Because what it really is, just to set the stage, it's a room with a lot of salt in it. Blocks of salt.
Well, it's built with blocks of salt.
It's built
right?
with blocks of salt.
Lining the wall.
And sometimes it has a so-called halo generator, which sends a salt mist through the room, and you have very comfortable chairs, and you breathe in the salt. And they quote one of the folks who has one of these salons, who says it's very good for arthritis and for regulating blood pressure, and big in Central Europe and Asia. But here's the funny thing. There's actually nothing behind that. There's no science, no reason to suggest that, in fact, it is good for arthritis and for regulating blood pressure.
That doesn't mean that it's not good.
And it doesn't mean it is good. So what you have is these rooms that people charge $35 or $40 an hour to sit in, and some people pay it. The one that's closest to home that kind of struck me, and this is the way it's described in the Times, there's something called the Wellery. I'm just reading now, which is a pop-up wellness center at Saks Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, where weary shoppers can refresh themselves in one of several salt booths for 10 minutes, $25 an hour, $25 for 10 minutes. So that's alarming on several levels. First of all, what's a pop-up wellness center at Saks Fifth Avenue? I mean, it's like you're shopping for clothes, you send someone else. If you have this in a floral print and when they come back, you've got a wellness center, it just kind of popped up. I don't even know what that means. But beyond that, there are shoppers at Saks who are taking time to sit with the salt, which is
no
real benefit.
We don't know if they're doing it. They're doing it.
Look,
this article is just talking about
the big thing that's driving this, if you read the article, which talks a little about franchising, is that it's a very low-cost proposition, that you're not taking a big chance if you buy one of these franchises or open one of these places, because guess what? It's just salt. So when you fill the room with salt, you don't have to have anybody monitor the room. There's no labor cost. The halo generator costs a few dimes, and you're just raking in the bucks.
So really, all this crankiness that you're displaying and talking about this is really you covering up your enthusiasm for this as a possible franchisee.
I'm driving the price down, and I'm running out immediately afterwards
to do this,
to pick up as much salt and halo generator.
There is the placebo effect. People may feel better.
Well, I think they're
doing this.
They're counting heavily on the placebo effect.
And it's $35 well spent. If you feel better,
we should open up a place called Placebo and see how that goes.
So in the Wall Street Journal, there's also a little article about a painting by Mary Cassatt. Mary Cassatt was an expatriate American painter, spent most of her career, if not her life, I guess, in Paris. Mm-hmm. And this is an article by John Wilmerding, who is writing about the little girl in a blue chair. And Mary Cassatt, oddly enough, was good buddies with Edgar Degas. Mm-hmm. Which is just funny, because not a sociable guy. Very much, kind of antisocial, mm-hmm. in fact. And as friendly and outgoing as Van Gogh was, Degas was pretty much the opposite. So it's funny mm-hmm. that he ends up friendly with this woman. And this is one of the few women that were really accepted by the Impressionists mm-hmm. as a member of the club. Mm-hmm. And she exhibited this painting with the Impressionists when it was turned down for one of the world fairs that France was having back at that time. And it turns out that to some extent Degas collaborated with her in this painting, actually helped her
paint it?
Yeah. Oh. And modified certain aspects. And so the article goes through what those might be. And of course, it mentions that, you know, by benefit of mm-hmm. modern technology, we can, you know, use infrared photography, et cetera, to examine these mm-hmm. possibilities and figure all this out. And you can actually identify which are his brushstrokes as compared to her brushstrokes.
And does it add a lot of value, appeal? Is it meaningful?
Does it add value? I have no idea.
No, but does it add?
It adds to the story. I don't think it takes away. It doesn't say. No one's saying, oh, Mary didn't really paint this.
No, but
Edgar kind of helped her.
No, but do you say, the painting, I'm enjoying that painting more. It makes a more visual impression because there's a Degas touch to it.
I don't know. I don't know about that, but you might understand why there are certain things like the cropping, where she literally cuts off aspects of the chairs and these big negative spaces. Well, they were both fans of Japanese woodblock prints, and you see a lot of that in these paintings.
Well, you wouldn't have thought he would have done it, or if she would have invited him to do it, unless they thought it necessary. I mean, right?
Well, they, they worked together. They painted together. It was a collaborative kind of thing, and not constantly, but clearly in this instance. So that, that's kind of an interesting article, fun article, just because of the personalities.
All right. Well, that is interesting. So something I found, Barry, you can, in the Times, you can tell me whether I'm just being too sensitive here, because I am sensitive. buried in the arts and leisure section. And I'll tell you what we buried in just a second. When I was growing up, at the same time you were, there was a movie called Animal Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an animated version of the George Orwell classic.
Right.
And it turns out it was released in 1954. I saw it probably in school, maybe 10 years after that. And it's really good. It was really good. And as many people are probably familiar, the George Orwell book and the movie was about a bunch of animals would take over a farm, which was run in kind of an egregious way by an unfeeling person. And once the animals take over, it's an exercise in collectivism. And they're going to work together in the way the Bolsheviks worked together in the early 1900s. And it turns out, while that's initially promising, it doesn't work out so well. And there are obvious parallels between some of the animals and some of the key figures in the Russian Revolution and what followed. So you have someone who seems a little bit like Trotsky, someone who seems a little bit like Lenin, Stalin. As we all know, that didn't work out entirely well, and it doesn't work out entirely well for the animals. So it creates a pretty striking impression about the, you know, how fraught that kind of collectivist approach is, even though it sounds good.
And so, you like the movie.
I like the movie a great deal. I remember it very well. I think it was even remade some years ago, but that wasn't really worth watching. So, but here's what's disturbing. Buried on page 7 of the Arts and Leisure, which is today, which is writing about a new version of 1984 of George Orwell's, they mention the 1954 Animal Farm classic, and they say casually, which of course was financed by the CIA.
Really?
Yeah. And I
go, what?
Oh, and that's, it turns out it wasn't made clear at the time, but in retrospect, people figured out, and it's now quite publicly acknowledged, that the CIA financed the movie as sort of their anti-communist education effort. And guess who fell right into the sweet spot of that effort, which is yours truly and a lot of people I know.
Yeah.
And in a way, it doesn't change anything because, first of all, no one said it was true or news. It's based on fiction, number one. Number two, it's George Orwell's story. It wasn't written by the CIA. And it's a fairly faithful adaptation of George Orwell's story. And yet, it kind of rubs me the wrong way. So am I being overly sensitive about this or not?
No, but I will say this. It reminds me of the movie we saw, the British movie, Their Finest.
Yeah.
And the idea that in that was sort of
that was a propaganda film.
That was a propaganda film, financed by a government agency to paint a certain picture of what was going on in the war.
Right.
So you wonder how much.
You have a good point because we all watched that movie and silently rooted for the people making the propaganda movie, and yet, not cool.
Revelation.
Yeah, it's disturbing. I have to rethink that. The other thing that is a very small piece in the Times about their motto, apparently in the late 1800s.
The New York Times motto.
Yes, the news that's fit to print. Apparently in the late 1890s, they decided to re-examine whether that should be their motto going forward. They held a contest, and this small article had all the candidates that came in. It turned out what happened was the Times decided that none of those candidates were worthy, and they stuck with their motto.
But they gave a prize.
They gave a prize, best one.
They didn't use it because
The ones that were all described there were, as the Times described, not worthy. They're not even worth repeating. They couldn't be less catchy, less interesting, less memorable. And yet, I was thinking that when I was growing up, Mad Magazine had a parody of the Times motto, which was highly effective, and that was called "All the News That Fits, We Print." And I don't know how that one didn't show up in the Times article. That surely would have been a prize winner in the late 1890s, and that would have been the motto even today, possibly. But we missed out on our opportunity.
Okay, I have a little follow-up to the laundry robot story. We're getting closer.
Yeah.
In the Wall Street Journal today, this weekend, there was a mention of something called the LG Styler. And it looks kind of like a refrigerator. It'll fit in your closet.
Right.
And what it is, no plumbing required. It's a kind of a box that you put your clothes into, and with the benefit of steam and a little heat, this appliance will let you eliminate odors and smooth out subtle wrinkles. Okay.
Really?
Yeah, so you can even, and you know, there's a special place for things like pants to hang on the door and still have their crease, etc. It will set you back about 2,000 buckos.
Wow.
But
wow.
There is that. You can magically just put it in that box instead of going all the way to the dry cleaner.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. The Times had a couple of articles about, I'll call body functions for lack of a better term, but, well, that's not a good phrase. But the first one, I want to get to the one about the brain in just a second, which is more interesting to me. But they did have an article about what's called the body's control tower, and that's the liver.
The liver.
The liver. Apparently, when you ask people what's the most important organ you have, very few people say the liver. I don't want to say what they normally say, but the liver doesn't get mentioned. And yet the liver is the key. It's involved in a host of functions. All the food that a person eats goes through the liver. And the liver controls all the metabolic functions, and that has implications in every aspect of the body. And it's so complicated that, in fact, and notwithstanding there are a lot of machines and substitutes for a lot of different organs in the body, medically there's no such thing for the liver. And the liver is very hard to understand and very dynamic. In fact, over a 24-hour cycle, the liver expands 40% in volume and then shrinks back. There's a lot going on in the liver. And this article credits the liver for the successful evolution of man to some degree, because it's able to filter through a lot of the toxins in everything you eat. And while that's somewhat significant now, it was even more significant years ago. And here's the quote. I wouldn't use this language otherwise. Quote, "Our ancestors didn't have healthy refrigerated food. They ate a lot of crap, probably literally. And the liver in prehistoric times was continuously bombarded with toxins. You need every mechanism there is to adapt to that."
So this tells me a couple of things.
Yes.
One is you should obviously take care of your liver.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know how exactly we do that.
Yeah.
But we should pay attention, take care of it. Number two, if you're going out to try on a bathing suit, you might want to go at a time when your liver is not expanded.
Is it low tide?
So yes, yeah. So you can figure that out.
Well, it tells me a third thing. And the third thing is that you have, you know, certain exercise programs which are based on what I'll call the prehistoric diet. The paleo diet, if you will. And it's nice to see something in the Times that says, yeah, that was people were eating a lot of crap then.
Literally.
So there you go. So you might think twice about that. But the article about the brain.
You should also mention liver is a good thing to eat.
They mentioned that too.
Liver's liver, a good thing you to know, eat. Like chicken livers, yeah. Calf's liver, et cetera, actually abundant with nutrients.
Yes. So. Yes, they say that chopped liver's got a bad rap. In terms of, there's an article about the brain, too.
Back to the brain.
It's hard to get away from that. So Mark Zuckerberg gave a commencement address.
Speaking of brains.
Yes, at Harvard. And what Mark Zuckerberg said at one point, in what was otherwise considered a highly successful, interesting, and positive, laudable address at commencement, he said that graduating students should not trust the story of innovation that Hollywood promotes, namely, quote, the idea of a single eureka moment in which a lone thinker has a groundbreaking epiphany and, you know, starts writing formulas on a piece of clear glass. He says, no one writes math formulas on glass. Eureka moment, that's not a thing. Well, the Times says, actually, it is a thing. It is a thing.
Yeah, but he didn't finish college anyway. So, right. You know, if he had finished college, he would know that.
He said the eureka moment, according to the Times, is not what Zuckerberg described it as, a dangerous lie. It's a real benevolent force of innovation and progress. And they talk about how the mind actually works. And sometimes, the solution becomes available to a person in a complete chunk. Insights actually do sometimes spring to mind in their final turnkey form. These aha moments tend to be more reliable than consciously, methodically worked out answers. Who knew? And the article goes on to say that, you know, if you're in some kind of analytical mode, you're pushing and pushing, you're actually less likely to come up with a big idea because your mind gets more narrowly focused on fine distinctions. You're better off pushing back and relaxing a little bit. And if, in fact, you've absorbed enough relevant information in that relaxed mode, your mind is more likely to make the connections in an odd and interesting way when you're not even thinking hard about it.
Well, we've talked about that before.
Yeah.
And you've said you rely on that kind of
thing. I do. I feel that that's the way I think.
Yeah.
I feel that's the way I think.
You research, you work things out, and then at a certain point you just sit back and let things gel.
Yeah, or I just, you know, suddenly it goes, oh yeah, this is how it all works out. This is how it ought to be organized. Here's the presentation. Here's the insight.
No, sorry, Zuckerberg.
This is Zuckerberg. Well, I guess he hasn't had a big idea yet. When he has a big idea, this is all going to start. He hasn't had that experience. Once he has that experience, there you go.
Yeah. Speaking of coming up with good ideas, turns out not every idea is genius. And we talked about this last week.
Right.
The Museum of Failures and the importance of being wrong. And on the front page of the New York Times today, a big article about behind Amazon's success is a prodigious tolerance for failure. Joke all you want about drone-delivered kale and arugula. Amazon's $13.4 billion bet to take on the $8 billion grocery business in the United States by acquiring Whole Foods fits perfectly into the retailer's business model. Bezos has built his company by embracing risk, ignoring obvious moves, and imagining what customers want even before they know it, mm-hmm. and not worrying about that these things don't always work.
Right.
You know, various ideas have lost millions of dollars, including the Fire Phone,
right.
They say. And what's interesting about that is even when those things happen, it doesn't cause them to shut down,
right.
or flail about trying to, you know, even make the Fire Phone work so much as, you know, go off into almost completely different areas. And I thought that was interesting about giving the customer what they want and need before they
even
know it.
Well, that's,
because wasn't that even an Apple thing?
Yeah, that's totally an Apple thing. And that's supposedly you know, the genius behind Apple from the word go, is that you don't ask what the customer wants, you ask what the customer will want.
Right. And so, but in any case, again, the importance of failure, the importance of taking risks spending money to make money.
But I think that's a very profound thought, and here's why. If you break it down, it's not so much failing. Maybe you learn a little about failing and you examine the failure and you say we made this wrong turn and that wrong turn, but I think it's more fundamental than that. It's the willingness to risk failure.
Yeah.
That's key.
Yeah.
And once you have the willingness to risk failure, you're out there looking for the big Zuckerberg idea, looking for the big epiphany, willing to give something a shot. And you have to have that approach. You know, this even goes, obviously, James Comey's been in the news a lot lately. And, you know, one of the things that got quoted about Comey, which was in the Plus column, was that when he was working with a large team of lawyers and they were determining what cases to bring, he asked people who had lost cases, and very few people raised their hands. And he said, if you haven't lost cases, you're not doing the job.
Right.
You
right.
have to lose
right.
cases because right. there's no other way to right. find out your limits and the limits of the law.
Yeah.
That's part of the job, is failure and seeing how far you can reach. And that's the mindset that you have to have.
And so on the, you know, back to Amazon for a moment. So, you know, they have some failures with things like the Fire Phone. But one of the new fun successes they come up with is this voice assistant, the Amazon Echo,
right?
The Alexis. And so the Wall Street Journal has an article this week that you're going to want to look at, and it's, you know, how to use Alexa.
Are you pointing at me, or are you talking?
I'm pointing to you because I have it on good authority that the Father's Day.
Really?
Gift fairy.
Don't give anything away.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah.
You're gonna want to look at this article, and you know, it apparently Alexa is especially good for cooking. You can shout out, Alexa.
Well, now I'm excited.
How many teaspoons in a tablespoon?
That's right.
Things like that. So. Yeah.
How do I make? Get me a reservation at so and so. I think that's going to be my cooking input. all right. So. So we're going to close with I look at an obituary of a fellow named William Sladen, who I should say at the outset, because we're going to make a little bit of a humorous point, but, you know, total respect for this guy, who's a scientist, died at the age of 96, did a lot of important research with respect to conservation and animals generally.
But the headline.
But the headline is William Sladen, expert on penguin libidos. And it sort of gives you pause. You say, really, an expert on penguin libidos?
Who knew?
Who
hear interesting things about penguins.
Well, not as interesting enough as this guy might have known, but, you know, who knew we were lacking in that area? And apparently, not only was that my reaction, but apparently others probably reacted that way to some degree. So the article, the obituary, includes sort of a defense on Sladen's part, with the significance of penguin libidos, and I'll just read from it. By studying penguins, which are highly sociable, Dr. Sladen said researchers could also gain insights into human behavior. For example, he learned that male penguins can initiate and consummate sexual intercourse even in the worst weather, including gales of 60 miles per hour. And here's his quote. Generally speaking, the sexual impulse must be great when these acts are performed under such adverse conditions. Well, let me...
So penguins have skills.
Now, not my point. This is what he used to figure out, that even for humans, the sexual impulse must be great. And my point is, couldn't he have just asked around? I mean, couldn't you just go to some dive bar in Brooklyn and say, what are you doing here at 11:30, 1 o'clock in the morning? Is it really that pleasant a place to be? Is the beer that good? Or is something else going on? I think he probably would have got the answer closer to home instead of invading the privacy of some windswept penguins out in the Arctic. But in any event, that was his work, and so he passed on. But
and so that's all we have for today. Happy Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day,
from
indeed.
Danson and Dan.
Reading the papers, and we'll see you next week.